Welcome to the C Word, a Conservatives podcast. Today we're talking about objects for use. I'm Jenny Mathiason, an objects conservator in Carmarthen in Wales.
I'm Solange Masher, a book conservator based in Sheffield in England.
And I'm Liz Hebert, a paintings conservator based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Aww. Good times, guys. It's nice to see you all. Yeah. Not that you listeners get to see us, but it is nice to look at these people.
It is.
What are we talking about today, ladies?
Objects of use. I can't actually remember what the idea was behind this topic.
Well, I know that this is a passion topic for Jenny.
Well, yeah, because I think that any objects that we do have in our collections should actually be useful in some way. I don't really see the point of putting something in a box for 500 years and not looking at it or doing anything with it. I don't see the point.
So that kind of use. Okay, I thought you meant like practical use.
It can definitely stray into that territory as well, you know. I think this topic will take us where it takes us.
Yes.
So I think that's kind of where we're at. We can share our different thoughts on it and stuff like that. I mean, Solange, I think that you do work on objects that, you know, are used because you need to be able to open a book.
That's probably why my brain went there first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that makes total sense to me.
And I do believe very strongly that when I restore a book, ideally I want it to be to a point where someone can actually use it, because that's like the soul of the object.
Well, yeah, that's the purpose.
To be used. It wants to be used.
When you do your treatment and you give it to the client afterwards, what kind of recommendations do you make for actually being able to interact with the object? Like, how far do you go in that explanation?
That's a good question. It really depends. Like, if it's an institution, they usually know already. Like archivists are really good. Like, they always know. And I'll usually point out like some areas of weakness, or like maybe even put some note in the housing. I think that can be really helpful.
That's nice.
Yeah. And if it's just a private person and it's like often it's like a family related object, like some grandparents' diary or something like that, then the main advice is usually don't open it too wide, basically.
Don't crack it open.
For the love of God, don't open it too wide.
With something like a family diary, do you ever do digital scans of the pages for them?
No.
Potentially a new offering at Solange's conservation.
Oh, an add-on. I like it.
I probably wouldn't be able to do anything more sophisticated than they would be able to do with taking pictures themselves. But I did once restore a house deed, which the owners wanted to frame, but it was on parchment and it's very big. So we realized in the end that it would be really difficult to mount in such a way that it would actually stay in place, because it's the nature of parchment is it kind of fluctuates, it changes in humidity. So that one, they ended up taking it to a photographer that I recommended to have it properly photographed, and they ended up framing the picture and keeping the restored document in the housing that I made for it.
A little facsimile.
Yeah, it is a facsimile, yeah. Which I'm normally not 100% in favour of, but in that situation it made sense.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I get that there are totally times when we can't necessarily use the real object, or when an object can't be fulfilling its original function anymore or something. Like, there will be definitely cases where that's the case, but I think that maybe as a profession we see that as the default, which I think is silly. Which I think maybe we should look at it from the other perspective and say that's a last resort, that it can't be used or it can't be moved or enjoyed in the way that it should be. And I slightly feel this way about art as well. Like, if you can't look at art, then actually does it have a function still?
Yes, I was thinking about this as we started the episode, because for paintings, there's no like use in the tactile sense. You know, it's very much, is it available for observation? Can we see it? Although I think that what would fall into the category of objects for use in the realm of paintings is more workshops and education of how a painting gets made.
Yeah, sure.
Making pigments and doing like that immersive experience more. But paintings themselves, you're right, if they're not on view, who's really getting to enjoy it?
I mean, it is slightly how I feel about stored paintings. You know, if you go into a museum and they're like, oh, yeah, we have tons of art. And, yeah. you know, for a fact, they only have like two paintings up.
Yeah.
And it's just full of hundreds of paintings. And it's like, but why? Why is this here then? Why?
I mean, archives are bigger than museums, right? It's just impossible. Yeah. And I know museums do cycle out, but maybe the frequency with which they cycle things and loan things isn't quite rapid. But at the Van Gogh, what they do is they have a lot of his drawings from his life, and they display them on one wall, and it's about five at a time. But every few months, they change them out because drawings
that's
are so
fun.
Sensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah,
to light. Yeah. So, but they do want them to be visible. So that's nice.
Yeah, I think that's a good compromise. Yeah.
I often think that there's maybe this is because I'm used to archives, but I think there is often this idea that the big value of an object is in how useful or an emphasis on its value as a historical object for study and for research. And that can sometimes be seen as like the most important thing. And then the kind of human connection is maybe less valued or less prominent in the decision-making process of how to restore something.
Yeah. I suppose there's a difference there with archives as well. It's often about the information that is conveyed.
Yeah.
As where, you know, was sort of more like social history collections and things. Like, I feel like it's much more, you sort of need to know how something was used, or like you sort of need to have an appreciation for what something was for, because you don't have, it's not just information that's being displayed to you. It's that this is a metal object. I wonder how this was used. I feel like archives is different in that sense, because actually it's about data and information in a whole different way.
Here's a good one. Okay, so I worked somewhere once where there was a researcher and they were looking at all the archives to do with this one person. And in the big, going through boxes and boxes of stuff, okay, in one of them, there was a letter that this person had written, and it was in a sealed envelope with a wax seal. And the letter had been written by this person before they took part in a duel, and it was to be opened if they died in the duel. They didn't die in the duel, so it was never opened. So then the researcher was like, can we open this, please? And this was the whole conundrum. It was like, do you break the seal?
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah.
And people were saying no, and I was like, open it!
Do it.
Because I think, well, the guy's dead now, so technically... Yeah.
So it's technically okay. I don't take the calico.
And also the contents of the letter, I believe, would be more useful than preserving the integrity of the seal, which could probably be repaired afterwards anyway.
Oh, that's interesting. I love it.
Yeah.
There's also the ethical thing there of like, do you respect this person's wishes?
I mean, we read diaries, even though those aren't as explicit in you can't read this.
True, absolutely like, true. And we donate letters all the time, and maybe not with the explicit consent of the person who originally wrote them.
People sometimes put in their will, don't they, that they want their diaries to be destroyed.
Yeah, absolutely. Or their paintings or whatever it is, you know, like just like completely get rid of it.
You know, I just learned about an artist, Rick Wouters. He was a Belgian artist, early 20th century, and he did like the academic track as an artist. So he went to art school and he got good marks. But what he would do at the end of every semester, he would burn his paintings that he had to do.
Oh, God.
Because he was like, I mean, I'm doing this to get a degree, basically. But then once I'm done, I'm going to develop my own practice. And that's what I want to be remembered for, not these pieces. Which is
Oh, wow.
Wow. That's some forward thinking about your legacy.
right?
Old.
Begins, you mean to go on. Wow.
Yeah, that's extreme. I love it.
Really curating your own life.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Curating it hard. That's incredible.
Wow. Why am I thinking of so much damage on the objects for use episode? I mean, I guess a lot
it's
of people,
okay.
that, a it's lot a valid of people point. Would argue counter to what we're talking about, that use is damage and so we shouldn't do it.
I mean, it creates wear and tear. It absolutely does. But I think if it gives the appreciation of an object that gives more than seeing that object static or dead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this will be a case-by-case basis, of course. But I think because we're trained to be really damage averse, mm-hmm. I think it's very easy to see all types of wear and tear as this is damage with a capital D. Mm. And sometimes it's just not, if something's made to be touched, because there are things that are, you know, like there's tactile art that's, you know, deliberately supposed to be touched. Yeah, that's going to wear down the surface. It's going to leave grease on it. Mm-hmm. It's going to lead to maybe corrosion or decay, but it's what it's meant to do. Then I think putting that as damage with a capital D is detrimental to the whole purpose of that art installation or whatever it is.
I really agree with that because I often get asked as a paintings conservator by contemporary painters, like people, like, what do I do to make my art last as long as possible? And I feel like it's sort of similar to just the general question in conservation, how do we make this thing last? And I always respond to them with the best advice I have, but really my conclusion is it's the conservator's job, whatever you do, to maintain it and give it that longevity. Don't worry about that so much from your standpoint. And with what we're talking about with objects for use, I agree that if it's something that can withstand use and it's beneficial to do so, then it's the conservator's job to maintain it past that use or conserve it in a way that use is then possible.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's extra interesting with living artists as well, because then it's sort of up to them what we do whilst they're still alive and things like that.
To a certain extent.
Yeah. Negotiation encouraged.
But this also reminds me of the great musical instruments episode that Fedra and I did. That was a wonderful interview. And that is all about using the objects and actually
considering
instruments for playability.
Yeah, absolutely. Because a guitar on a wall, that's nice, but a guitar being played, that's an instrument.
Guitar wants to be played.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think that's true of actually more objects than we think of. I think it's easier to think of that because we can all sort of relate to, well, music, it has to be played.
Mm.
But I think it's true of more things, if we think about it. Like, I mean, in theory, costume wants to be worn.
Yeah.
I'm not saying to anyone that you should all go and wear your historical costumes. That's not what I'm saying at all. In fact, I caught someone doing that once and I was not happy. But what I'm saying is that some certain types of historical costume might actually be things that are actually in use. I'm thinking of like vestments and things like that, maybe religious garments of some description that might be taken out of storage and used because that's part of their life. That's what they're meant to do. So sometimes, you know, that's how it goes, even with things that are maybe in collections or cared for differently. It also makes me think of some advice I was given when I was first working with historic costume, which was that you need to support it as if it's on a body. You know, like you need to actually support it like that, because that's how it's meant to be treated. And I think that's a really good point, rather than just stuffing it in a box and folding it up.
I think one of the things that makes conservators cautious about how we treat objects in terms of their use is not necessarily having the full picture of what will be the importance and use of the object long term. And certainly there's hesitancy, because sometimes in order to make something usable, I'm thinking really about books here, you may need to change, for instance, something to do with its binding structure. And that could obscure some of the evidence of how it was originally made. That might be really beneficial in terms of making it usable, but further down the line, that could end up being really important information.
But isn't that where documentation is so important, that you've documented how it was originally done, for example, as you're taking it apart or something? So we can actually preserve that to a certain degree anyway.
Yeah, you can. You can. I don't really believe in documentation. I do it, but I don't necessarily believe that it's going to, you know, like, It might not stay with the object forever.
No. I mean, you're totally right, of course. You're completely correct. It's very important that we do documentation, but it's not a guarantee that that information will still be available in the future. So it's true.
I can think of an objects for use argument, or rather an example. I don't know. I'm going to float it to you and see if you think this is an objects for use example, because it's sort of a facsimile. So in Florence is essentially the Disneyland of the Renaissance, right?
Love
and
that.
So
they should have that on the tourist brochures.
They should.
I stole that from an article from like the 50s.
I love it.
So it's been that way for a very long time. And the idea is like you're walking through the city and you're seeing so much of the sculpture, the architecture, the decoration that was originally there at the time. But actually, quite a few of these are facsimiles. They are replicas of the originals. And this has been done because if you leave some of these statues out, there's the concern about pollution, lots of birds landing on these objects. Potentially, there have actually in Florence, there have been acts of terrorism that have happened near the museum. So like these are the concerns and these are the reasons why they provide these facsimiles. Most notably, there is a very famous bronze statue of a boar. And a lot of people go to see the statue and then you're able to rub the nose. And so the nose is all shiny and gold. But this is a facsimile. It's not the original. And I had an entire debate, we did a proper debate when I was in Florence about the ethics of this, essentially, because it's not like a lot of the people interacting with these objects are aware that they're fake. So does the fact that they're not original and that you don't know affect the experience?
It might affect the experience afterwards. Like if you discover, then you would probably feel a bit betrayed. You would probably have maybe a slightly Disneyland whiplash of like, oh, that's not real.
Yeah, I think when it comes to a specific object like that that people want to interact with, I think it matters.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with somewhere like Florence, it's the overall aesthetic is
what you're selling.
That's the experience, the kind of connection with history that is being fostered.
Yeah.
Actually, my husband and I went to Florence a long time ago and we were sitting looking down on the city. And I kind of thought to myself, he was saying, you know, it's like, looks like it would have in whatever,
the Renaissance,
hundreds of years, right? Because they've deliberately maintained that through policies, like you can't build houses, they're maintaining that skyline kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, that contributes to that kind of overall, you're creating a historic experience in a way, the Disneyland experience.
Yeah.
But it occurred to me, I thought, God, it would be so frustrating to be a young architect, you know? I think there's a balance to be struck. Because one of the things I love about London is how you can turn a corner and there'll be some medieval building, but like right opposite there'll be something really modern. And I actually really enjoy that patchwork, that kind of piggledy thing. You're not trying to hold on to an idea of what things were, because you're never actually going to make it exactly how it was.
No.
No, I think that is interesting and true. I mean, in some cases, for a lot of European cities, you know, this was because they were bombed to hell. So there were opportunities to build new, nice, modern things in between bits of the old. So sometimes it's circumstance, maybe more than policy.
Well, yeah.
But It's an interesting thing to think
about.
But
then that shows history, doesn't it? If the reason the modern buildings are there is
the living cities.
I don't know.
New York, Tokyo, these are similar as well. But maybe it's because they have such large populations that it demands evolving in the city, whereas Florence has really been pretty stagnant, and it's largely based on tourism now. You're going there because you want to have that experience. So there's a motivation to preserve it in that way.
Yes, and I think there'll always be pockets like that, you know? Like, I think there'll always be places that are kept like that. But it, you know, when you were talking about the boar and everyone rubs its nose, it made me think of something that came up in a museum I worked in. And that's that they had a bronze bust of, I think he was like a famous swimmer from the area or something. And anyway, he had a really shiny nose because it was good luck to rub the nose. Mm-hmm. And I think they looked at me with an expectation of, she's going to hate this. And I was sort of like, it's sort of local folklore though, isn't it? That's nice. His nose isn't going to come off anytime soon. It's going to need to be a couple of hundred years of frequent rubbings for there to not be a nose left.
Yeah.
Honestly, I just thought it was charming because that's how people choose to interact with that object. And actually, as long as you as a museum decide that you're okay with that, then actually I think that's a total valid use, because otherwise it's just, I mean, how exciting are busts really? I mean... It's just that, and here's some dude, because he's usually a man, here's some dude who once did something important. They're not that interesting, usually, not even from an artistic point of view, because it's just like a really good portrait. But for this to be something that actually people interacted with physically, I thought that really added to the whole thing. Like, this is something people come here for when they feel like they need a little bit of luck in their lives. How cute is that?
Because we're talking about bronze statues and the gold rubbing. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out the current movement surrounding the statue of Molly Malone. Have you heard about this? Molly Malone was an Irish woman, and there's a statue of her in Dublin. And like you were saying, Jenny, quite a lot of these bronze statues are of men. But when you have a bronze statue of a woman, the object on the body that they rub is the boobs.
So I was thinking, I seem to recall this is a rude story.
It is a rude story. She's got shiny boobs. And the argument against this is that it's removing any context about what she actually did and what it's supposed to be commemorating her for. And it's rather degraded her in this very public way. So there's a group that's currently trying to get that particular statue raised up on a plinth. Although, I have to be honest, it's not a very good statue. I would just say, make another statue.
One that's less boob-worthy.
Yeah.
I hadn't really considered use of an object as being something that's a little bit malicious, if you see what I mean, or like not malicious, but certainly lascivious.
Yes.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? It's funny because where my brain went before you said that was whether use of a statue can include acts of gentle vandalism, like the recurring thing of always putting a traffic cone on a certain statue's head.
Sure.
The classic thing that happens in all Scottish towns.
Interesting. So,
we've been drunk, this needs a hat. It's such a classic move. Students in particular put a traffic cone on that person's head. But that's sort of a ritual and an ongoing thing. And like, it's a rite of passage for drunk students to do that. So the question is whether that's legitimate use of an object.
Yeah, I think so. Well, okay, because what is the purpose of a statue being put up by the authorities is to project some kind of idea that they wish to hold up as an ideal or something to inspire people or something, you know, but they've chosen and then it's sort of imposed on the public.
Mm-hmm. So if the public wants to subvert that.
And so putting a traffic cone on their head is a nice way of kind of going, oh, you're not that important.
Take it back.
It's subverting it.
Whatever.
I quite like that.
I might not agree or care.
I quite like that.
I mean, it wouldn't be a problem if you were leaving, a bushel of roses at the base of the statue?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. And that's another way of using. Yeah, they create, there's a focal point which you might engage mm-hmm. with or react against and demonstrate in some way.
And then we'll have different emotional reactions yeah. to that, depending on what that monument or statue is, for example, whether it's commemorating something really sad or whether it's just commemorating a rich person, for example. They do evoke very different reactions.
Yes.
Which is when we, which brings us back to Molly Malone, doesn't it? Where it's like, this is meant to evoke a certain feeling. It wasn't really meant to be there for boob grabbing.
No.
Way to bring a woman down. And
absolute travesty.
You should put some kind of like electric shock in the boob.
You know, in a more positive way, and this is not a suggestion for Molly, because I don't think she needs more help. But I do remember in Stockholm, back when I was a small child, that there were several statues that had heating in them. Like they were standing on the street and you could nestle up to them. You could give them a hug if you were cold. And it was actually a really sweet, sweet
That's
little thing.
Adorable.
And there, of course, uses that you should hug them.
I love that.
That's good street art. Yeah.
More of that.
Yeah, and then
please.
While you're standing there all cozied up, maybe you read the plaque.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe you learn something. Maybe you know who that person is now.
What are some other objects for use examples?
I mean, time-based media springs to mind.
Mm.
Because often those are installation pieces that are meant to be enjoyed in a certain way. Or they can even be video games or something interactive. And surely the whole point of a game is that it's played.
I know a lot of gamers are really trying to preserve games from like the 80s and 90s or from consoles that no longer exist. So they've adapted them in some way for modern consoles.
Yeah. And that arguably is time-based media conservation because it's making sure that that lives on in some way and people can still enjoy it.
Totally.
Because it's not actually, you know, it's not the same to like have a video of this is how this game was played. Then that's documentation. That's not preserving the actual game
experience.
Yeah. So I think time-based media falls heavily under the category of objects for use, if we can consider them objects as such, because they're not necessarily physical; they're digital or experience-based. But I feel like they are very much things that should be experienced, sort of like art needs to be experienced.
Yeah.
And then once you've created the digital, like a more modernized version of the game, would the actual object itself, like the would it be like the disc?
Yeah, cartridge maybe.
Would that thing still be preserved? Like just as an object in its own
probably,
right?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I would probably say so. Because it's so interesting to see how these things would have originally been distributed or, like in the era before digital downloads, you know? This is how we used to pirate things. Here's my pirated copy of The Sims from from someone's Big Brother.
I'm specifically thinking on this line of thought about Tetris. So Tetris is very popular. It's a bit of a cult thing, and it's still
so
played very much. And the professional Tetris players, the ones who are doing it competitively, use, I believe I'm right about this, they use a console that works with modern computers, but it's the same like device setup that was original to Tetris back in the day. And this is a very interesting example of objects for use because they've kept that type of controller actually as the competition to get to like the highest level or break Tetris has become more of a thing. They've had to change the way that they hold it.
At the controller?
Yes, it's the same controller, but they hold it in a different way than it was originally designed for. And this essentially allows the players to more quickly manipulate the Tetris pieces. So they've actually used the object and evolved their use of it, which is very interesting and only possible if you maintain that original design.
Yeah. Oh, that's wild. I like that. That's good. I like that.
Love Tetris. Super cool.
Yeah. Oh, you nerd. I jest. I like way nerdier things than Liz does. I'm the biggest nerd here, I think.
I'm also very partial to graph paper.
Oh, good old graph paper.
Yeah, right?
Shout out to graph paper. But it's true that with like things, if we have objects that are used sort of actively, then that gives us a greater burden of repair and maintenance. That's true. Arguably, how are we not in favor of that? Because actually that gives us more work.
Yeah.
If we're being crass about it, that keeps us in business, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it does.
And this example also gets at what Solange was talking about earlier, where we don't really know who we're conserving for. So we just have to do the best that we can. And like, there's no way to have known that this object would be used in a new way, but by preserving it, it allows for that to happen.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, isn't it?
And that's the human connection, people.
So it is. I kind of wish Chloe was here because she could tell us about the silk banners that she preserves, because often they're used in marches and actually they're not just hung in a museum. Often the sort of things that she works on are like taken to protests or commemorations and things like that. So they're actually being carried by people through the streets because that's what they were meant to do, which I think is brilliant. And it's also a very specific example of objects for use, but very much something that I think I don't know how you could not be on board with that, to be honest. It's what it was created for. It's still here. It's marvelous. Let's do it again. Let's revive that.
And also it's so hard with protest to, I find, especially since we're going through a lot of, I'm seeing a lot of protests now in the last few years, like it's become a cultural movement. I think in our modern age, we have a very hard time remembering the past or feeling connected to it. Maybe because we have so much digital media around us, it doesn't feel very tactile. So having a protest and actually having a memory of the like heritage of protest and feeling connected to that, I can imagine lends a new energy to the you're protesting.
I think that's a really good point, because it makes you part of a greater human chain in some ways, you know, like we've been caring about this for hundreds of years. Here's some evidence. That's really nice and quite profound, really.
Yeah, it is.
Do you have any objects from your family history that are in your home or that are possible to use?
I have my grandfather's plate. Well, it's not a plate, it's a tali.
Which is?
So it's like a metal, it's like a very, like a round metal plate, basically. So in India, you use a lot of stainless steel cups, bowls, plates, and you usually have the name etched. You often have your name etched in it. So I've got quite a lot of with my name on them, because like you, so when you get married, you're given like a set of all of these things with your name in. The one that was my granddad's doesn't actually have his name on it, but it was just the one he always ate from, and I really like it. My kids use it.
That's really nice. Most of my family stuff is still in Sweden because I haven't inherited yet, so I haven't had to worry about what I need to keep. I think the only bit of family history that I have here is very much my own personal history. So like I have the teddy bear I had from that I was given when I was like 3 or something, and that's still here and getting cuddled, so that is an object for use, and it is knackered, but I love that teddy bear. How about you?
I have a deck of cards from my great-grandfather that he played a lot of solitaire, and so he used that very often, so he's interacted with it and I interact with it. Cards are a big thing in my family. We all play cards.
I like that. Yeah. Oh, I like that a lot.
And I think probably we end up with objects that we don't even know whose they were.
Especially with the like secondhand shopping. And
Totally.
Oh, yeah. Here's
the thing. You have it there? Nice.
I use it. Right here in my studio.
So when is it from?
I don't think it was like a special plate of his or anything.
Yeah.
It's just like a plate.
Yeah, of course.
I just like it. I just liked it. So I kept
the everyday mundane things can sometimes be the best.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I took away from some people I was talking to, because they were really sad that their grandma had like pre-cleared out her house. So she'd gotten rid of loads of stuff and then just sort of left them the sort of what she considered the treasures. And they were really upset about this, because actually they weren't the things that they treasured at all. They were the usual knickknacks, that they were allowed to play with, or that she was always touching and handling. It wasn't about the like cat made of crystal, or the it wasn't about the fine china. It wasn't about that. So it's
fine china is so rarely used.
I know.
It's so upsetting. If you have it, if you get it as a wedding gift, use it. Use it for breakfast. Use it for
See, object for use. Do it. And that's it for this season, guys. Thanks so much for listening. I don't know what your summer plans are. Personally, I'm going to go have a baby. So for season 17, I might not be here very much, but you'll be in safe hands with Liz, Solange, and probably Chloe and Fedra as well. And in the meantime, I wish you all a very happy summer and see you in autumn. Thanks for listening. Today you've listened to Liz, Solange, and me, Jenny. Join us next season for loads more good content. In the meantime, you can of course check out our website at thecwood.show, email us on thecwoodpodcast@gmail.com, or follow us on social media. We're on almost everything. Don't forget to check out our Patreon as well, as we have loads of good content on there, including special bonus episodes that only our patrons get. The intro and outro music is Spring Bedidi Music, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. As always, this has been a Wooden Dice production.